Trying to figure out where we were. I wrote down this thing called political, and I think we're not that. Oh, I know. We were talking about Alaska and politics. One of my, I think, favorite perceptions. And it just, I think we were talking about maybe Neil Humphrey was always astounded at the not only the legislature's interest in the university and the general public's, but also the ability to of faculty or staff or any citizen in Alaska to work with or against or through the legislature and that kind of a thing. And just wondering if that was your perception, or maybe he wasn't here long enough to feel comfortable in that process.
No, I think Neil and I were absolutely in alignment and totally in agreement with the same kind of a notion, which is interesting. My coming from the East Coast and him coming from Nevada, and it's very, very distinctive kinds of political operations. But it goes something like this. Many, many people connected with the University of Alaska believe that the only real political force is the legislature. In other words, if you want something done, you go to the legislature and you sell it, and they do it. And so that's where the bread gets buttered. There's a complete lack of understanding that political forces can be external from the legislature. In other words, and getting right to the point, a higher education institution can be a powerful political force. A quick example, even the briefest of histories and a quick look at the situation in the state of New Jersey, and you will see that Rutgers University, which produces the lawyers who become the legislators and so forth, is a tail that very frequently can wag the dog. I maintain, and I couldn't say it too much publicly because it could be misconstrued and there could be negative repercussions from the legislature, but the University of Alaska, in my opinion, is probably capable of becoming the most potent political force in the state of Alaska for a variety of reasons, which we don't have to go into here, but just briefly, just the geography of the university. It's everywhere in the state. It is more places in the state than any other entity of the state is, other than citizens. The number of employees, thousands of employees, turning out thousands of students. So it can be a powerful political force. All it has to do is get its act together. It hasn't gotten its act together, and it is totally delineated and disjointed in terms of its political approach, and the university doesn't understand it as a body, as a collective body, but the legislature does, and the legislature plays the university like a 20-string banjo. I mean, just plays one end against the middle, the Anchorage-Fairbanks thing, Hugh Malone down there strumming on the Kenai guitar, and what's his name, Bill Ray, strumming on the Southeast Juno guitar, and Orville Freeman and others doing the fish rumba down in Southeast, and Sackett and whatnot doing the interior bush thing and so forth. And we sit here getting strummed around by this process. Okay, the first step to deal with the process is to convince the university community that it puts its situation together and as a body goes forward and supports something that is unique to the university from beginning to end. Not unique to the university, but viable on behalf of the university from beginning to end. By that I mean, for example, the budget. Let's get a budget that's the best possible budget, all considerations having been viewed. Adopt that as our budget and go down there and try to get the legislature in a unified way on our part, the university's part, to adopt it. No, that's not what we do. The board adopts a budget. It becomes, by that adoption, a policy document. It is their budget that they are submitting. And every Tom, Dick, and Harry and Mabel and Susie connected with the university then runs off to Juneau or to their local legislator and says, I don't really like that budget, you know, in the broad sense. We need 5,000 here, 100,000 here, 50,000 here. Okay. It is not a bottomless pit of money, Every 10,000, 20, 100, million, whatever that the legislature jams in comes out from some other place. So university employee X may be successful in getting some of money given to them, but that means that university employee Y loses because the money comes out at the bottom. Now, if that's seen by people to be a victory of sorts, well, I suppose it is, but it's a very distinctive a victory, which in the long run hurts the university. So what we have done is set up a situation where we say to the legislature, forget the regents' budget. Play to the political overtures that you get, and do what you want with that budget, and everything will be all right. And that's exactly what the legislature do. Example. The capital projects budget submitted during the last year by the regents, which was well-conceived, well-intended, well-developed, well-thought-out, and needed, was 98% different when it came back from the legislature. They'd eliminated everything that the regents asked for and jammed in upwards of $20 million worth of projects around the state, of which, in my professional judgment and that of many others, were totally unjustified, unrequested, not needed. Now, that's just on the capital side. Hugh Malone jamming in an additional $250,000 for Kenai and getting away with it and so forth are just examples of this thing. Once the university becomes a unified body, which says in effect to the legislature, here's our budget, this is what we need, give it to us, they'll give it to you. Because if they don't, they won't get voted back into office. Okay, I came along with a political activity policy, which was generally seen by, I shouldn't say generally, was seen by a few people who have difficulty seeing to the end of their nose, as kind of a Heinrich Himmler move from 1929, violation of the First Amendment and all sorts of other nonsense. Obviously, that was not the case, and all you had to do is read the policy, which incidentally the board adopted, and it is our policy, and that is that if you're going to shoot your face off to the legislature, you have to make it very clear that you're shooting it off as John Citizen, and hopefully it'll get taken that way by the legislature. But if you're going to pawn yourself off as a spokesperson for the university and use university letterhead and funds for travel and whatnot, then you're in violation of the policy. Now, all that policy is really, and all I wanted it to be, was a signal to people that there is no hope for the university unless we get our routine together and we all sing to the same or we march to the same drummer. And the only way I could have done that was, if we're talking about budget, for example, was to make the budget development process a rational one which people accept. Then they could march to that single drummer, that single budget document. And we did do that. Much to the chagrin of a lot of people, we had every departmental request for this the 79 budget was brought forward. The cuts were all made by the local chancellors. They were not made by the central office. I didn't make any cuts on the budget. All I indicated to the board at the board meeting and to the chancellors was that I had three or four priorities, and they were sabbatical leaves for members of the staff and so forth, things of that type. All the departmental budgets were there for the board to look at in support of these. Now, a lot of the chancellors, one in particular, a local one, as a matter of fact, chose to suggest at the drop of a hat that any kind of cut made in the budget was not made by the chancellor but was made by someone else. That simply wasn't true. The chancellors made the cuts, and then the board essentially adopted a budget that was almost 98% what the chancellors had brought forward. Now, if we had gone to Juneau this last year and said, as a unified group, that's it, that's our budget, that's what we want, period, that's what we would have gotten. We didn't. And you're not going to ever have success unless you change things. Now, one quick note on this campus, on the Fairbanks campus. It's going to come out soon, and it's sad. This campus, with all of the problems last year in terms of not having enough money to buy periodicals and put books in the library, this campus this year is going to lapse about $600,000. It's going to lapse $600,000 because, in my judgment, despite repeated requests to the Chancellor that his administrative director of fiscal affairs, Frawl, is an incompetent, which in my opinion he is, despite suggestions, which I would never have pulled rank and done anything to of a personnel nature, because I think that's the Chancellor's responsibility, they're going to lapse $500,600,000 from this campus. I think if this campus allows that to take place without taking a toll, exacting a payment, well, then they deserve it. But it's really cost this campus not so much in the $600,000 this year, but the $600,000 that the legislature is going to say next year when it looks at the budget that you really don't need because you didn't even spend it last year, hey, plus all the deals that the Fairbanks caucus had to cook to try to get some money into the budget this year. And now they have to go back and face their colleagues in Juneau this coming session and say, you know, I'm kind of sorry, you know, that I, you know, asked you for that $250,000 last year and now we're turning back six. Anyway, I mention that because those are the kinds of things that you can't have happen when you're going forward with that unified tune that everybody's singing. You can't have one unit of the university not exercise the kind of control either end. We have the same problem in Anchorage. There's a $500,000 deficit at Anchorage Community College. Now, we're going to come out in the black across the board, but those two pockets are going to have to be dealt with. The one we're dealing with, and in terms of the under expenditure on this campus, it's almost completely a political problem dealing with it. But anyway, that's the political. And yes, Humphrey and I totally agreed. Most of the time we laughed because politically, I think these things are so basic as to be almost bordering on juvenile in terms of what should be people's level of understanding. And it's not here. And it's just bad history. There was always success here going down and getting what you wanted. It never really mattered 10 years ago because the budget was so puffed up and basically overfunded in terms of cost effectiveness. Again, there always have been those pockets that get hurt. That it really didn't matter. No one really got hurt. But anyway, now it's going to hurt, and it has been for the last 3 or 4 years, and it will continue.
Let's just get back to the resignation of Dr. Humphrey. When would, you know, did you see this coming, or was it a somewhat of a surprise? I know we discussed the one incident, but I'd like to get it down. Was it a surprise in terms of your not realizing that Humphrey was, in fact, felt he was his professional reputation was threatened to the extent that he all of a sudden wanted to leave, I guess about 20 days notice?
Just about.
Yeah.
I guess, again, kind of a yes-no answer to you. I did observe an increasing kind of depression, and that's too strong a word. I don't mean it in the psychological sense, but there was kind of a professional depression that I observed with Neil. It was a job was beginning to get him down, He was tiring, you know, a lot, and so forth. So that's the yes response. Yes, I could see something happening. The no is I didn't have the slightest idea it would reach the proportions where he would resign. And I guess I had maybe a short period of advance notice over most other people, but certainly not a long one. And one of the reasons why I think was that this was such a short notice thing in every respect was I don't think Neil knew it was coming, because I know I had conversations in early December with Neil and his wife and his daughters. I remember we were over there, for example, for Thanksgiving dinner, my wife and I, and his daughter was just beginning to feel more comfortable in terms of school. The other daughter, visiting from Nevada, was thinking about coming up here and spending more time. She was away at another school, but there was talk about maybe summer courses and so forth. Rumors suggesting that Neil's wife was bothered by the cold and the dark and so forth. Absolute nonsense. She was probably one of the most well-adjusted, tranquil women I've ever met. She was perfectly content with her with her role, as I could see, was also my wife's opinion, and my wife was quite friendly with her. So I think that six or seven major events and five or six minor events, and I once calculated them on a piece of paper and came up with 13. 13 things occurred in about a two-week period and just zeroed in on Neil, ranging from him being weathered in Anchorage for 2 days and being strung along and not doing as most Alaskans would do and getting out of the airport and going into Anchorage and doing something. He kept on thinking the next flight would be the one that would get out, and he ended up spending a day and a half in the airport, you know, all day, all night, and half the next day. Neil was very conscious of making the best use of his time, and that kind of a thing can be very depressing, you know. Also, when you are led to believe by what you hear and see that that's the order of things, that, you know, you can get down in Juneau for a two-day trip and end up spending 6 days there, or get into Sitka and never get out, and, you know, whatnot. And you know, ranging from those kinds of mechanical things, with the ice fog that also settled in Fairbanks around that same time and didn't allow any flights to get out for a day or so, plus the treatment that he received in the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee in late October and November, treatment by the legislature in general that he saw coming in terms of the session. And I believe that, that's the one thing that a lot of people have overlooked. I don't think Neil was looking to go down and face that legislature in session with the kinds of messages that he was going to have to bring down there, not his own, but the messages of, well, actually the very messages that I had to bring down come the end of December and early January when they went into session, such things as the deficit, such things as the overstatement of fringe benefits so that we'd have a couple of $1 million to play around with up here, which was just downright cheating. The deals that were cut, the overpayments to people for relocation expenses, the purchases of equipment, the inflation of the budget in terms of personnel, where there was no intention of hiring personnel, the, you know, all of this endless array of problems. And I think Neil said, I have too clean a record at my age, I guess he was, what, 49, 50, to just totally tarnish it and corrode it in this situation. That was the way he saw it and left. The board's immediate reaction to that was, and I would suspect this would be one of your next questions, well, first, the obvious, they were dumbfounded. They could not believe that they would not be able to go back and talk to Neil and persuade him to do otherwise, and there were all sorts of promises that they were willing to make and so forth. There was nothing that that board could offer Neil Humphrey that he felt that he wanted. It was totally a decision that came from the world of in Neil Humphrey's head. It wasn't the world of what the board could do for him. So I told the board when they said, well, we'll go talk to him and we'll persuade him. And I said, you know, you're wasting your time. I know this man. I said it in a nice way, but basically what I know was that Neil Humphrey was one hell of a stubborn guy. When he got an opinion, he got it, and that was it. And I did not think that he had arrived at this opinion lightly and was not going to reverse himself. So once they found that he would not leave, that he would not reverse himself, then those one or two board members, particularly again Millie Banfield, who had supported Schwartz over Humphrey as the second choice, actually she wanted him to be president, then that's when Schwartz's name came up as a possible, and they contacted Schwartz, and of course he had still been unable to find work, having searching for that previous year. And it was pretty much through the, again, the pressure politics of Regent Banfield. I might hasten to add that she has nothing even resembling that kind of ability to pressure the board at this point. I guess a couple of strikes was enough. Schwartz played the board along, you know, for, if you'll remember, about a month, saying, yeah, I'm giving it some thought. I had never had any opinion other than the one which actually ended up proving itself, and that was that Schwartz was anxiously awaiting appointment for another job and was using this Alaskan problem and situation to better his condition. I had also reason to believe that Schwartz's departure from University of Indiana and Purdue, you know, Fort Wayne campus was not totally a decision made independent of the world around him by Don Schwartz. I might quickly enter that he's recently received a no-confidence vote in Colorado from his faculty. I was always afraid of Don Schwartz because he had an inordinate number of jobs in a short period of time, and that usually indicates one thing or another. But anyway, he didn't come. And then that brings us up to my appointment.
I guess the question is, given the knowledge of where we've been for, you know, the last couple of years, what kind of reflection is it on, say, your own ego, what you like to do, that you took the job as initially as administrator, and then it evolved into president?
Well, the response is probably so obvious, and I don't mean that to detract from your question. It's a good question. The response is so obvious as to be perhaps lost. There are a very small number, about equal to the number of states, land-grant universities and state colleges with land-grant status. I don't know what the total number is. I guess it's somewhere between 300 or something, state colleges and state universities. The opportunity to become the president of a university is about, and these are totally fabricated statistics, but I'm sure that must be, in terms of being an employee in higher education, the statistics must be somewhere around 250,000 or 500,000 to one. So I'd be dishonest if I sat here and gave you all of these expected responses about the challenge and so forth. I mean, the immediate thing was, my goodness, here is a governing board of a state university system who, for whatever reasons, feel that I have enough of what it takes to deal with probably what constitute the worst array of problems facing any university in the country. So it was I guess what I'm saying in a nice way is, it was a colossal ego trip to be considered and asked to accept the job. I can honestly say that there wasn't a second when I said, gee, do I really want this job? Of course I wanted a job. Now my ego will come bursting forth at this point. It never occurred to me for a minute that I wouldn't be able to do it, because I've been watching it for a long enough period of time to have a sense of what had been wrong in the past and needed to be corrected, what had been done wrong by the people who had attempted to deal with it, and probably was in a good position, better than perhaps anyone else, to see these things, certainly from the standpoint of the board perspective, being their executive officer. The brief period as a staff assistant, a special staff assistant to the president in the form of Humphrey, watching mistake after mistake after mistake by Hyatt and Ferguson. Plus the fact, and a lot of people don't ever want to pay me my due for this, being an administrator, an executive officer of a college in the system in New Jersey is not small bananas. I mean, that's a pretty rough terrain to play around in, and also to survive in. I don't think I have to tell anyone that New Jersey politics are not exactly tea parties. It is not exactly a tea party either to have been an assistant superintendent in a very, very large public school district during the early 60s, particularly one which was about 20% black, experiencing very, very serious racial unrest. So I think I had a very good background in terms of gaining management experiences and developing managerial techniques to deal with problems. I have never been considered for a position, a key executive level position in education, that wasn't to deal with specific kinds of problems where people were not having success with them. My promotion to an assistant superintendency was not because out of the 700 people employed by that district, I was the best in all respects. I was the best because it was a district in terrifying transition and caught in the throes of racial unrest. It was the first high school district in the United States that had an occupation by black students. They closed the place down for a week. Again, I had that experience. I then went into the higher ed system in New Jersey and had that experience with the Vietnamese situation and the Cambodian situation and what students were doing in that period of time. And, you know, so these were institutions in great transition and unrest and so forth. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm not a person as easily thwarted by problems, nor am I intimidated easily. That might be an understatement too. Some people would say that in a different way, but so you know, it just never occurred to me that the situation would be overwhelming. I'm also, admittedly, a political type. I think I know what it takes to survive politically, and I think I know what it takes to serve up for politicians. And I don't mean this negatively or in a derogatory way, but serve up what they need to survive and operate with. You cannot keep your legislators off balance and expect them to support you. You have to work with them and provide them with the kinds of things that they need to do what they have to do too. I'm also committed to certain kinds of things, such as the right of the legislature to have oversight responsibilities with the university budget. I think it's absolutely preposterous to consider that we here on the Hill in higher ed, or wherever that hill may be, hold all the answers, all the expertise, and all the education, and we don't deign to deal with politicians who want to stick their faces into our business. I think that's nonsense. We're spending tax money, and if we can't justify an appropriate expenditure of tax money, then we ought to move on. So I'm not bothered by that. I remember Bob Hyatt saying to me when I was here about a week, I said, how's the situation with the legislature? And Bob said, oh, they come into Juneau once a year. We go down and do our song and dance, and they give us our money, and that's the end of it. Well, that used to be the end of it 10, 15 years ago. It's not the way it works now. Universities and colleges, the public sector across the board have fallen, and most have survived, because they have been able to see that times change. And so anyway, I accepted the job with all of those notions swirling around in my head. A lot of people don't believe this, but it's absolutely true. I was probably the most surprised person in Alaska when they offered me the job. I was sitting outside of an executive session, the only executive session the board ever asked me to leave, while they talked over the problem in December. February. And when they called me back in, I felt that there was probably an even money chance that they would leave me in some acting capacity for a while. And when they said that they wanted to name me president with full powers of the presidency for approximately 2 years, whatever it was, 20 months, I was very surprised. Never occurred to me. And there are a lot of people, I'm sure, that are convinced that there were all sorts of subterranean meetings and sessions. It's absolutely not true. As a matter of fact, Jeff Cook left the meeting early to go somewhere. I forget now what it was, Regent Cook, and he was even more devastated the following morning when he heard, you know, he was surprised. So I think it was, I characterized it then and I still do, as an ultimate kind of a compliment in view of the problems that this university had, for a collective body of 11 people to, among themselves, say the best option we have at this point in time to deal with these problems is to name this man president. The charge they gave to me was, again, this might be hard to swallow. The charge they gave to me was, go do it. There were no instructions, don't do this, don't do that, step lightly here, they said none of that. They said, do it. They also said, do it until the day you're replaced, which I did. I worked until, as a matter of fact, I worked over the weekend, awaiting the arrival Saturday of Dr. Barton. Now, that's a question of my style, too. I wouldn't give up the ghost. I also might add, and I think it's, since we're on a delayed tape here that nobody will be hearing. I have been offered a presidency in Pennsylvania. I have accepted it, and I have been told that I cannot announce it until the governor announces it. And the governor of Pennsylvania has his own problems right now, and the least of which is naming me president. But I have the job. It is effective the day I leave here, August 2nd. And unless the governor reverses the recommendations, now in Pennsylvania, the governor picks the president. Unless he reverses the recommendation from his board of higher ed and his secretary of ed and his commissioner of ed, which is unlikely, they tell me, I will assume that position August 2nd. Now, I bring it up because there's absolutely no way in hell I would have been in a position to take a run at and get that kind of a presidency without this kind of experience behind me. And so I don't have anything but thanks to everyone involved, you know. And the problems in the college where I'm going are kind of mini problems of the same type they have here. They have some collective bargaining problems, some credibility problems with the legislature. They had $1 million deficit. They have been in a kind of a managerial void for about 6-7 years. President who was president for 13 years, kind of a nice, scholarly, dignified gentleman who kind of, somebody characterized it to me as gave up the decision-making ghost in 73. So, all of that, obviously because of this, there are a few people that could have, and if this sounds like I'm tooting my own horn, I guess I am, but there are probably a few people who could have finalist status for about 4 or 5 presidencies.